You got some good cameras, dude.
Oh, thank you. Here.
Like very crisp. Sure. Yeah, thanks. Is this a Havanese? Or?
Yeah. That is a Havanese. Yeah, how'd you know?
Well,
we know
he's a curious fella. He knows these
folks,
things.
A curious fella.
A lot of folks don't get that on first.
Well, it's because my wife is on the board of directors of the Aspen Animal Shelter.
No way.
So she's a real... She's had every beast in the book.
Did you get some good skiing in this season?
I only do cross-country now.
Cross-country now.
Yeah. But I did. Yeah. Actually, it's still snowing.
I know, but today was closing day, wasn't it?
It's still going on.
It's still going on?
It's
going
to go to June.
Oh, my God.
They got 18 inches of snow 2 days ago, and it's still snowing.
Holy cow.
It's crazy. People sent me pictures. It looks exactly like midwinter.
Like midwinter.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I saw that you brought Guthrie out there for a couple days or?
We did. Well, it was actually makeup shows from COVID.
Oh.
We had tried to book. We had three shows. We had Vail, Telluride, and Aspen.
Yeah.
Booked in 2021, and they got canceled. Then in early 22, it got canceled again. So this was the third time's a charm tour, we called it.
Oh, my God.
And so we went back out and rebooked everything and got them all in, all three in.
How do you feel about Vail? Because most Aspenites aren't, you know, isn't there a rivalry or is that
like,
not true?
It's like the Republican ski resort.
Yeah.
No, it's Vail's Vail. The mountain itself is amazing. But, you know, it's so close to Denver, it gets a huge week. Are you a skier?
Yeah, big skier.
Oh, okay. So
yeah, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people come up from Denver for the weekend because it's accessible.
It's so close, yeah.
It's not that extra 2 hours or hour and 45 minutes to Aspen, you know. So, it just gets too crowded. But if you ever skied Vail, it's an amazing mountain.
Yeah.
The town is, you know, it's an ersatz Australian village.
God, I got tagged by the dog.
Oh, I thought you jumped because of the big word I used.
The dog just jumped into my lap.
I said ersatz and you jumped, and I thought, wow, do you have like an allergy to vocabulary?
Like, what is touching me? Oh my God, that was good. The thing about need to contain myself
I'm
now.
Gonna, I'm going to let everybody know. Zach has an allergy to large vocabulary.
Large vocabulary.
Or small unusual vocabulary.
And small dogs, too.
Yes,
thing about Aspen, though, is once you're in that town, you've got the town, and then you have the
you're
four
there.
Mountains.
You're there. Oh, yeah.
The skiing's insane.
There's nothing like it.
I've been to Vail like one time, and then I never went
back. Aspen is, nope. I mean, it's world class. It's, you know, it's one of those places where you can have a world class, like, lifestyle experience, you know, whether that's eating, shopping, culture, whatever it is you want. And then you have this world-class, you know, alpine experience on four different mountains and backcountry and everything in between. Yeah, it's pretty special, I have to say.
Do people bother you when you walk around the town, or are they
kind of
leave
you alone? No, I've been there, you know, I've been there for over close to 40 years.
You've been there before it even...
Oh, yeah. I went there in 1968.
Yeah.
Which is crazy.
On a college trip.
College ski trip.
College ski trip.
Yeah.
You saw an ad in a paper that said, what, like $120 flights, everything.
That's right. I
would say
you've done your research.
Yeah,
very
yeah,
good.
Absolutely.
Good, Zach. Good. I'm already impressed. Yeah, and I was at Temple University, and I was a skier back east, you know, skiing the little, you know, blue ice ski resorts.
Yeah. What mountains? It's still there?
Oh, I used to go to Spring Mount in Pennsylvania when I was in high school with a rope tow. And then I went up to Vermont. I went to Massachusetts to, you know, Brody and, you know, all those ones, Camelback, you know, Elk Mountain in Pennsylvania. So I did them all. But then, you know, once you go out west, you get spoiled very quickly.
Did you ever take ski lessons, or were you basically self-taught?
I was pretty much self-taught. And then I became a telemark skier in the 90s. And then I skied telemark from all through the 90s into the early 2000s.
I've never done cross-country skiing. It doesn't seem... There's got to be less adrenaline, right?
No,
or it's fun.
There's no adrenaline. There's just a lot of aerobic.
It's just aerobic
weakness.
Work.
It is work, but it's beautiful work. You know,
okay.
It really is. It's the, you know, you work your shoulders, your arms, your lungs, your legs. It's really an amazing workout. I mean, you do 40 minutes of cross country skiing, you're
done.
Worked.
Yeah.
And you're not going to get whacked by a snowboarder or another skier. You're not going to hit a tree.
That's going to be the headline. John calls out snowboarders on
no,
a Zach Team show.
No, don't do that either. But the thing is, you know, if you hit a tree while cross country skiing,
you're fine.
It's your fault.
It's your fault. That's the big point. It's your fault.
It's your fault. You've got no one to blame.
Wait, so you were just in Florida for the premiere of a movie
that
you wrote a couple songs for. What was the movie?
This was also a pandemic project. It was called, it's called Gringa. It just was released yesterday, the 21st. And it is streaming now on many platforms, Comcast, Apple Music, and all sorts of things. It's a great, great little movie. It was done by, the director is a friend of mine. And during the pandemic, you know, he finished it in 19, and he was, you know, he's getting ready for post-production, and the pandemic kind of shut everything down. He called me and asked me if I wanted to write a song for the movie. And of course, I was home, and I had some time, so I did.
And what did he give you? Did he give you, like, a prompt or anything? Or
He gave me a treatment, basically told me, didn't send me the entire script, but he, you know, he basically told me what it was about, and I went for it. And then he liked the song and he said, "Hey, you want to do some more? I need music." I said, "I'll do as much as you want." And I began to churn out these songs, doing a lot of some collaborations, some co-writes, and also collaborations performing with various people. So as it turned out, I ended up doing, well, I wrote 5 songs. One of them didn't quite make it. So I ended up with 4 songs in the movie. And then there's one more song in the movie that was done by Jesse McCartney from Maroon 5.
Oh, yeah.
And he has one. And then the score was done by another guy named Tim Williams, who's amazing. But we all kind of collaborated together, and I got to do a duet with a great Mexican female named Jimena Sariana, who's a huge star in Mexico. And she, I wrote a song in English. And she rewrote the verses in Spanish, and then we sang it together in Spanish. And I had to learn it. I took high school Spanish, so I was, you know, part of the way there. But, you know, so I learned it, and we did it in Spanish, which was a unique thing for me. And then I had another gal named Daphne Willis write a song that me and my niece wrote.
No way.
And I needed a great female singer. And Daphne used to live here in Nashville. She lives in L.A. now. She's amazing. So she sang that one. And then I sang two other ones.
Is your niece a musician?
Yeah, she's a performer here in town.
No way.
Yeah.
So
Anna Lee, her name is.
And what does she call you up constantly and say?
No, she's actually pretty respectful. I help her out.
Why? If I was her, I'd be calling you up 24/7. Why be respectful?
I helped her in the beginning. I helped her get going, making her initial demos. I think she just wants to carve it out herself. You know? But I've helped her, you know, here and there. And she came up with a great song idea, and I finished the song, and then... I actually asked her, I said, "Do you want to sing it in the movie?" And she didn't feel comfortable singing it. So I got Daphne to do it. Then there was a really cool song. My wife found this guy on Instagram named Servon Campbell from South Carolina, who had this, like, I would call it a song idea. I didn't think it was complete, but I really liked what he was doing. And I got a hold of him. I DM'd him and I said, "Hey, you want to take this song to another level?" And this was actually before the movie. And he went, "Yeah, let's do it." So he and I collaborated via Zoom, and then he came to Nashville, and we completely fleshed this thing out.
This was just a totally random guy that your wife
totally
had?
Random guy, yeah.
And she thought, "Hey, this guy has a good song.
And I heard it, and I liked it, too. I liked where it was coming from, but I didn't really feel like it was a complete song. It was just a great idea. And then we finished it. And you're going to love this story. This is really crazy. And this shows you how this whole project kind of went. While I was writing the other songs for Gringa movie, I had completed this other song with Servon Campbell. And he's kind of a rapper. He sings, but he's most kind of a rapper. And so I had it. And I didn't know what to do with it. And then just randomly, I said to the director, I said, "You know, I said, I've got this song. I said, I don't think it's right for the movie. There was no Latin American content. It wasn't skewed in that direction musically. I said, I think it's a really cool song. I said, but I don't know. I said, you know what? He goes, send it to me. Let me hear it. I sent it to him. And he said, okay. He said, you're not going to believe this. He goes, well, I'm going to send you a clip from the movie because I had not seen anything. So in the clip, the young gal, she's living with her mother, who's a real estate agent in Southern California. Her mother dies in a car accident, and she wakes up by herself in their condo, you know, basically alone. She's wearing a shirt that says "Do Not Disturb." The song is called "Do Not Disturb."
Oh my God!
Yes, I know it's almost too too incredible to be real, but it's true, totally true. And the song that Servan came up with was called DND, Do Not Disturb. And he said, "Did you know about this?" I said, "How could I have known?" I said, "You didn't even send me the script." And he said, "This is too much." He goes, "I love this song." He goes, "We're using it." And so it's the opening song in the movie. So, yeah. So it was meant to be in a sense, yeah.
When you're DMing this guy, is this sort of a random guy in the world who's a songwriter?
He's a guy who's posting stuff on it on.
How do you know these people aren't crazy? Or I mean, isn't?
I sensed he was okay.
Sensed he was okay.
He was real respectful, and he was young, and he got excited. And I said, "This is great. We can do something really cool with this." So
okay, so we have to check this movie out.
Yeah, it's good.
Is it crazy that you know? You're obviously the Philly guy, but you were born in New York, and pretty much from the start of your professional career at Atlantic, it's all happening in New York.
Daryl and I have never recorded in Philadelphia.
You've never recorded in Philly ever.
Nope.
So was that a decision to push the Philly brand forward? Like, was that a benefit to make you guys stand out?
It was kind of a decision, there were circumstances involved. One is that we had a very really not a good relationship with a guy in Philadelphia who we were working with who wasn't helping our career. In fact, he was hindering it. It took us a while to realize what was happening. And then we ran into Tommy Mottola in New York City when he was working at Chapel Music as a song plugger. And he liked us because our publishing was signed to Chapel Music. And so we did kind of a showcase for them to kind of show off our new songs. And he said, "Well, what's your deal? I like what you guys are doing." And we said, "Well, you know, we don't know what our deal is. Our deal is we're in a bad business relationship in Philadelphia and we don't want to be there." And he said, "I'll take care of it." And that was kind of how that started.
And he was 20 years old, right? Or 21?
He was the same age as my age. He was 22.
So did he have a demeanor to him that was confident or like?
Yeah, he was a New York, Italian New York. He looked good in a suit, you know.
Yeah.
And he was very aggressive, and he said, "I've never managed anybody, but I'm going to take care of this." That's basically.
And he went it.
Yeah.
But were there conversations throughout your career to say, "Hey, let's brand these guys as the Philly guys because it stands out a little different"?
No, it's just now. Once you're, it's like Rocky. Once you're from Philly, you're always from Philly. You can never leave.
What is a Philly?
You can climb the steps of the art museum, but you can never leave.
You can never leave.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. What's a Philly chord progression? I've heard you say like some of your songs have a Philly chord progression.
It's more than that. It has to do with, you know, first of all, Philadelphia R&B is pretty sophisticated when it comes to the harmonic, you know, construct of it. Has to do with using a lot of major seventh chords, has to do with using like major, like minor nines, chords that are a little bit more jazzy, I would say, than your average pop kind of a thing. A lot of it comes from, a lot of it came from, well, see, Daryl and I were working at the Schubert Theater building. We were songwriters for this guy. And above us, a few floors above us, Gamble and Huff had just begun their production career. They were always around Philadelphia. Kenny Gamble had a band called Kenny Gamble and the Romeos. Leon Huff was a piano player. But then they really solidified as a production team. And they took an office a few floors above us. So we were friends. And we would see them and, you know, all that sort of thing. And at a very critical point, it was like, if we were going to extend if our career was going to, you know, evolve, it was either go upstairs and work with Gamble and Huff or do something else.
Yeah.
And we didn't want to be part of, even though I love them and they're some of the greatest of all time, we felt that we could carve our own niche, you know, our own career path. And the only way to do that was to leave Philadelphia.
And then you have this audition at Atlantic. And
well, it's way more complicated than that.
It's way more complicated than that. But did you ever interact with Amit?
It's way more complicated.
It's way more complicated than that.
We auditioned all over New York City and did showcases for every record company. And as soon as we would finish playing on that evening, they would come up and go crazy. you guys are the best. Wow, I've never heard anything that sounds like this. You guys are unique.
And then nothing. But
then the next day, we'd ask the guy we were working with, what happened? They passed. It was always, they passed. And we're like, what do you mean they passed? They said they liked us. No, you're not right. And we're like, something's wrong. So Daryl and I scrounged money together, and we took a flight to L.A. We went to L.A. because we didn't know anywhere else to go. And we had never, neither of us had ever been to L.A. And we also didn't realize that you needed a car.
You needed a car to get around.
So we checked into the hotel on Santa Monica Boulevard, and all we could do was walk from that hotel to the International House of Pancakes and Barney's Beanery, because that was the distance. It was about a mile. We could walk back and forth. But there was a guy from Chapel Music who, because of our connection with Chapel, he met us at the airport, let us actually sleep on his couch the first night we got there. And then he began taking us around, and he took us to Earl McGrath's house. And Earl McGrath, you know anything about Earl?
Not really, no.
Earl was very good friends with Ahmet Erdogan.
Okay.
And he just passed away recently. There's actually a record out with the things that he's done. He was basically an art dealer, a bon vivant, a raconteur, and a very close friends of Ahmet Erdogan.
But how'd you get in the room with him?
The guy from Chapel Music knew him.
And set it up.
So we went to Earl's house. He had a little bungalow right off Santa Monica Boulevard, right behind the Troubadour. We went in, and he had all this amazing artwork, and he was very, you know, he was very, like, intellectual. And so we sat in his garden, and we played him some songs. And he started laughing. That's the thing I remember the most about it. He actually started laughing. And we were like thinking, okay, this is really weird. Because it was a very eclectic, you know, house. It was very, you know, it was out there. And he said, are you guys for real? And we said,
what does that mean?
Well, that's what we said. We said, yeah, we're for real. He goes, what are you doing playing songs in my house? He goes, I'm calling Atlantic Records right now. He goes, you're going to be on Atlantic Records. And we said, okay.
But this, what you were playing had to be much more folksy sounding.
Oh, it was totally, it's totally artsy folksy.
It sounded like the first record, probably.
It was Whole Oats.
Whole Oats. Sound like Whole Oats.
It was Whole Oats.
Yeah.
It was the genesis of the music on Whole Oats. That's right.
So then, and then he calls Ahmet, and then what, you fly to New York right after?
Yeah. He called Atlantic, and he said, I'm sending these two guys. You're going to listen to them. So we, then with Tommy Mottola, we went to Atlantic Records, and we went into a little studio. And I remember Daryl was not feeling well. The piano was kind of out of tune. Into the room came Mark Meyerson, who was the head of the company at the time. Jerry Greenberg, another one of the principals.
And Arif Martin. Yeah.
And we played the songs. And at the end, we did our dog and pony show, basically.
Did you keep Tommy around because you felt like, hey, we're supposed to have a manager?
He kind of set it up. And then at the end of the interview, Arif Martin just said to me, he goes, I love them. I will produce them. And that was it. Boom.
And he didn't fool around like everyone else was saying, oh, we love you, but we'll pass.
He stood up. I will produce them.
Yeah.
If Arif Martin said he was going to produce you, that was all that mattered. Arif was one of the greatest producers of all time, you know.
Yeah.
And he held so much sway, and his musical opinion was so, you know, appreciated and revered that, you know, he just.
Could you have made those early, like that first record without him? Did you guys have this?
We could have, but it wouldn't have been the same record.
Yeah.
You know, the thing about Arif, which made him so amazing, was that he was a pure musician. He didn't care about genres and styles. He was trained classically. He loved American jazz. He loved folk music. He loved blues. But he had all the tools. You know, he had all the skill. He could write symphonic arrangements. He could write for strings. He understood music as pure music and not as any kind of fad. He was not swayed by fad or what was on the radio. So when he heard these songs, he treated each song, he served the song, which is my mantra. It's what I learned from him. It's the way I think about music today, even here, you know, here in Nashville. I run every session the way Arif Martin ran his sessions, because that's how I learned, because I was in the room with him. So, you know, it made an indelible imprint on my approach to how to make records. And so to this day, I do exactly what he did.
Yeah. You know? When you think of Hall & Oates songs, there's so many iconic background vocals or like riffs that happen in between the chorus with the vocals. Mm-hmm. Did you guys slave over that stuff, or was it kind of obvious?
Like, it was not easy.
It was just easy.
Super easy.
Like, Kiss on My List, like all that stuff that happens super in between easy. The chorus, like you just basically do it.
Yeah. The thing I think a lot of people also don't really sometimes, you know, identify is that one of the characteristics of a lot of our big hits is that the background vocals are singing the hook.
Yes. That's what I'm asking.
It's very unusual.
That's what I'm, yeah.
The background vocals are singing the hook, and the lead vocal, which is mostly Daryl, of course, is riffing around it and dancing around it, you know, musically. And it's a trademark. It's a signature trademark. We didn't consciously think about it. We just did it.
That's what happened.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the first three records were on Atlantic, and then you guys then moved to RCA for your fourth record, and that's when you had your first really big hit. No?
Well, yeah, that's another story. Though.
Did RCA bring a certain mojo to it that you weren't getting from Atlantic?
Nope.
It was just the hit Sarah Smile that took off?
What happened was we did, we did Hall & Oates, which was very singer-songwriter folky. And then we did A Band on Luncheonette, which really we Daryl and I both consider that to be our real first album, because it was written in a condensed period of time.
That's my favorite album front to back.
Well, it's my favorite album that we've ever made.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's interesting that the sophomore album would be the one, but that's okay. And it had She's Gone on it. And,
right.
You know, and She's Gone was a masterpiece, and it still is. And, you know, and I'll say that, you know, I'm not bragging when I say it. It just is.
It's perfect. It's so tight.
It's
There's no fat on that song. Everything is perfect.
Everything is right. Yes,
yeah.
That's correct. Well, and we released it, and of course it didn't become a hit. It went to the top 40, and then interestingly enough, Tavares, which was a R&B group at the time, they covered it and had a number one R&B record with it. And we said, okay, there's something wrong here. If these guys can record
they
our
don't
song,
even do the modulation at the end,
I
right?
Know,
they left it out.
They can have a number one song. Why can't we have a number one song? It's our song.
Yeah.
And I've honestly felt our version was way better.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So then we released it again. And it went into the top maybe 20. And so now the time has passed. And because we had no mandate because A Band on Luncheonette wasn't successful and She's Gone wasn't really successful commercially, there was no reason for us to do the same thing. You know, so we did an experimental rock album with Todd Rundgren, which, you know, in retrospect, I didn't enjoy doing it that much. But in retrospect, it was an important component that led to the future, because it enabled us to do also. We weren't kind of restricted to a certain style, because we could do anything at that point. And then we here again, we thought, well, it's not working at Atlantic, and we got to offer to go to RCA. RCA was interesting at the time because they didn't really have an act like us. They had John Denver and they had, you know, some people like that. We kind of fit an empty slot in there.
Specifically
roster.
That you were a duo or just sonically?
Just our style.
Yeah.
Our style, whatever that was, you know. So we switched to RCA, and we said, there was a guy named Christopher Bond who was in our band in the early 70s. He was from Philadelphia, and he had moved to LA, and he had become a producer and a session guy, and he knew the studios, and he knew a lot of the session players. And he said, look, you guys have been recording in New York, you're out of Philly. He goes, you should come to LA. We got the best studios, we got the best players. And at the time, in the mid 70s, the best records were coming out of LA. They really were. And so we thought, okay, what do we have to lose? We have nothing to lose. So we went to LA. And for three albums, we made those albums with him. And the first one had Sarah Smile on it. That became a hit. That opened the door. And then Atlantic Records, on the coattails of Sarah Smile, released She's Gone. And that finally became a top five record. And then Rich Girl followed that on the following album. So we got on a roll, basically. And that put us on the map. And we began to, we were always touring, but then that put us in the bigger rooms, the bigger venues. And that really put us on the map.
At one point, didn't you meet with George Martin of the Beatles.
We did.
And you guys said, he basically, did he offer to produce you guys? And you said, well, we're not interested. Or it just didn't work. Really. It just didn't flow.
It was just a lunch in New York. And it was kind of like, we didn't, it didn't seem like, you know, in retrospect, it would have been really great to work with him.
Do you think
so? Very interesting. Sure. He's very similar to Arif. Very, very similar.
Yeah.
I mean, what he did with the Beatles was exactly what Arif Martin did with us. George Martin was a classically trained, you know, musician who could hear music outside of you know, the restrictions of whatever the pop flavor of the month was. He didn't care about that. You know, look what the Beatles did. They had cellos and strings and flutes and, you know, F trumpets and all kinds of odd, you know, then, of course, sitars and, you know, and so on and so forth. Yeah, George Martin was a pure musician. He just treated each song for what it was.
Yeah, makes sense. So there's a great story in the book where there's this big MTV competition where there were two planes.
Yes.
What was this? This is the craziest thing I've ever heard.
Well, that's the excess of the 80s.
You couldn't do this today, right? The environmentalists would be freaking out about private planes going everywhere.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, let's take a look at some of the big pop stars today. They have no trouble with their private planes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So let's not go that far. But nah, you know, it was a promotion, and MTV was hot. MTV was the thing. We were hot. We were, you know, and you're talking about the 80s now.
Yeah.
We were at the top of the pop world, and we could do no wrong. And MTV wanted to do something extravagant. So we had a contest. The winners of the contest, I can't remember if I started in L.A. and I went to Kansas or vice versa, but Daryl and I were both on the each coast, either New York or LA, and then we both got on a plane with a bunch of fans, and we flew toward the middle of Kansas, which was the center of the country, and one of the planes landed first, and that was it.
And then what? The fans on that plane won a ton of money. And,
they won
and,
something.
Or
yeah.
they won something.
Yeah, they won something.
And were they cool, the fans? Did they know how to handle?
They
knew how to hang and,
sure,
and
they were great. Yeah.
And be cool. And,
yeah.
This is hilarious. I want
you
to
You know
do
what
today.
Someone should do?
What? Yeah.
Someone should find those fans and interview them.
And interview
no
them.
No one
right?
has ever done that, by the way.
Do you think they're around? How would we find
Unless
them?
Unless they're dead. They're
dead. No, they got some of them got to be around. How
well,
would we find them?
I don't know. If they were 30, they could be 80 years old by now.
So when you're like one of the biggest rock stars in the world, I know that like this might sound crazy. I know like of course you're out running around and causing debauchery and being a rock star, but I just feel like your schedules at the same time would have to be so crazy with touring and recording.
It's completely crazy.
So
everyone always thinks that, you know, that I love the 80s because that's when we were the most popular and we were on top of the pop world. And if far be it from the truth, the 80s went by in such a blur because all we did was work. You know, we wrote, we recorded, we toured, we made MTV videos, we did promotion, press, went all over the world, and it never, ever stopped. I love the 70s because everything was new. Every city was new. The people we met were new. The experiences were new. We weren't jaded. It was just this constant, you know, discovery. It was a decade of discovery, which I think is way more interesting than a decade of, as you know, might
excess.
Say, debauchery, excess, you
yeah.
know. Yeah. Although, you know, I won't disparage the music we made in the 80s because it was great. It was really great pop songs. But we made good music in the 70s, too. So.
Yeah. What happened in 79, not to jump around, but you say this in the book, in 79, you guys were in basically arenas and playing massive rooms, and then you go back into clubs.
Yeah.
Was that the most depressing thing ever?
Well, it could have been, but I think, and I will give credit to myself and Daryl on this one, is that we made lemons, you know, we made lemonade out of lemons. Is that the right phrase? I don't know.
Yeah.
What happened was we, after the three in a row, Sarah Smiles, She's Gone, Rich Girl, after that, we made an album called Beauty on a Backstreet, which was terrible. It's the worst album we ever made. My opinion. I'm always speaking for myself here, by the way.
Yeah.
You'll have to talk to Daryl on the other side. But anyway, it was what happened was Christopher Bond was in a really bad place, drug-wise and mentally. And we were in a great place. We wrote some really weird songs that just weren't, there was something wrong. And we were in L.A. for the third album. We didn't want to be there anymore. We had spent 3 years in L.A. on and off in between tours, recording, writing, and basically living in L.A. And we wanted to go back to the East Coast. We weren't comfortable there. We just felt we had kind of run out of steam there. And Chris Bond lost it. And so that album is colored to me personally by the very depressing environment that we were in, or place we were in mentally. So when that album kind of bombed, we didn't know what to do. And so that really took us out of the game because we had no hits. And once you have no hits, of course, you know, things change. So we started playing smaller venues, and we thought to ourselves, well, you know what? We can look at this as a, you know, kind of a career ending moment, or we could look at it as an opportunity. And what we did was we had been recording everything we had done up to that point. We had recorded with studio musicians who were great. But our goal was to have a band that we could play live on the road and go directly in the studio and translate the energy of touring into the record. And we just didn't have it. So we basically borrowed Elton John's band in 1978. Caleb Quay, Roger Pope, and Kenny Passarelli, who were on the Yellow Brick Road tour with Elton. And Elton was off the road, so we basically borrowed his band. And it was really cool because it started to happen. We got the feeling, oh, you know what, our instincts are right. This is the right thing to do. And we went into the studio with those guys after touring with them, and we made Along the Red Ledge, which I think is a really good record. Here again, not commercially successful, but a really good record. And so we got on the, we realized that, okay, this is the direction we need to go, even though those guys weren't going to be a permanent solution. And then also, it was the first album that, what's his name, David Foster ever produced.
That's right. And
we were the first act that David Foster ever produced.
And wasn't it a mixed experience? Or, I mean, he's a genius, to me about this.
David Foster's an amazing musician.
Yeah.
He wasn't for us.
It wasn't for you guys.
But
nobody was for you guys, except maybe Arif Martin.
That's right.
But basically, you guys were the only ones who could bring the sound out.
You guys were for you guys.
You guys were for you guys. Is that fair to say, though?
Yes, you guys for you guys, yes.
Yeah.
I'm going to have a t-shirt made.
That you guys are for you guys. Yeah. But, like, yeah. Why was it, was he just, he brought too much of his?
Well, I'll give you an example of how you get off on the wrong foot with someone. He played us a song one time on the piano, and the song went, it was like this. Ding, ding. Something happened along the way. Then he said, whoa, whoa. After the love is gone. And we went, nah, it's not for us. One of the greatest songs of all time.
Was right? That his fault, though? What was the...
No, he just said, I think you guys would do a great job. And we were like, yeah, maybe, I don't know. That was a big mistake.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
But anyway.
And then what, did you hear Earth, Wind & Fire playing that?
Yeah, and then he produced Earth, Wind & Fire, and that song was a mega Grammy
And then
winning.
You go, oh my God, that could have been ours.
No, not really. We never looked back.
You never looked back.
Right? Nah.
You can't. Why? So, like, I'm a guitar player, and I grew up idolizing G. Smith.
G is a great guitar player.
Why is he a great guitar player? Did you know? Was he always great? I mean, of course he's great. But...
Well, he was after that that experience with that band with Roger and Kenny and Caleb. That's when we started to assemble the what became the '80s band.
Yeah,
and that started in '79 into '80. And one of the first people we got was G. E. Smith.
Where'd you find him?
I don't know where we found him. I really don't know where we found him. He was in New York. And he auditioned, and he was very charismatic. He was bigger than life personality. And the thing about GE is that he's a student of the guitar. He's a real student of the guitar. He, you know, he's one of these guys, you know, he came up through the bar band thing. He can play any, you name a rock song, a classic rock song, he can play it. You know, it doesn't matter. And he has a lot of facility with... being able to, to really dip into his encyclopedic knowledge of guitar stuff. That's the kind of guy he is. So he was a big addition because he really added a lot of fire and charisma to our live show. And then he brought along Mickey Curry, who he had played with in bar bands. And Mickey Curry had never played in a professional band before. So we were his first big, you know, step. And then eventually we got T-Bone. Tom Wark.
Yeah. I love the story, too, which you probably told a million times, but you were auditioning someone else.
It had come down to two guys. It had come down to this really good-looking guy from Long Island with long blonde hair.
Somebody should interview that guy. Where's that guy?
Yeah, where is he today, right? and then T-Bone. They were the two. They were both great, you know, really good bass players. But the one guy looked really good. He had a real vibe. And T-Bone was very kind of flannel shirts and, you know, knit cap and, you know, kind of quiet, but really great player. And then the good looking guy made a very fatal mistake. He told Daryl that he thought it'd be a good idea when he got in the band that he should sing Kiss on my
list.
What
an idiot. Who does this guy, who does he think he is? What is he doing?
Let's put it this way. That was a bad career move.
And Daryl literally said in front of him, he said, let's go get the other guy.
He said, John, let's get the bald guy.
Let's get the bald guy.
Because T-Bone was bald.
Yeah.
And he said, look, let's get the bald
moron.
Guy.
What a moron. What is he doing?
I have no idea.
But this is crazy. But that band, is that...
that was the best thing that Daryl and I ever did, was hire T-Bone.
Yeah.
He became the real rock, you know. And I will say this in a town full of amazingly talented musicians. He was the best musician I ever played with.
Wasn't there a session you did in Nashville with him?
Yes.
And weren't, like, Michael Rhodes and all these bass players, they wanted to see him. Like, they were all...
He was without a doubt, you know, he's passed away, God rest his soul, but he was the best musician I've ever played with, just as a pure musician.
Yeah.
I had never heard him play a wrong note, ever, on any instrument. And he played guitar, unbelievable guitar player, unbelievable keyboard player, unbelievable bass player, and just musical sensibility beyond, you know, anybody else.
And did him and GE really click in the band?
The band was an incredible band.
Yeah.
It was, you know, a great assembly. And then we always had Charlie, our sax player, from 75. He joined us in 74 or 75. So, you know, but it's just one of those things, you know. It just was, the chemistry was there, the skill, the talent. It was all in one place. But I brought T-Bone. My first album that I recorded in Nashville in 2007, I got with it with one of the a great engineer named Bill Vorndick, who just passed away just recently, and he asked me who was going to play, and I said, well, you know, I'm going to count on you to get me some really great guys, because I didn't know the really good players in town, and he assembled some really good guys. He said, who's going to be on bass? And I said, well, I'm going to bring T-Bone. He goes, oh, that's not a good idea. I said,
that's so Nashville, isn't it?
So very Nashville.
That's so Nashville.
Well, he said, well, you know, these guys are the top guys. They don't like to play with guys they don't know, and, you know, he might not fit in, blah, blah, blah. I said, don't worry, it'll be fine. And then we started recording the sessions, and then all these bass players started showing up. Steve Mackey, who ended up being one of my best friends in my band now, and Michael Rhodes, and all these bass players start showing up. And the engineer, Bill, kept saying, why are these bass players, like, showing up? They're here to see T-Bone. And so, obviously, you know, it was pretty clear from the very beginning that he was, you know, he was going to rock this thing.
Yeah. Do you experience, like, that to me is the most Nashville thing I've ever heard. Like, what is that? Why is that a thing?
Well, it was just that he didn't know, you know.
Yeah.
In his defense, Bill Vorndick's a great engineer. He became a professor at Belmont, you know, and engineered some of the greatest country albums, you know, of all time. But, you know, but the musicians were all open-minded. It's just that Bill just didn't know who he was. But he found out quite quickly who he was, right?
So in the 80s, you guys inducted the Temptations into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And there's this awesome video online where you guys start, like, spontaneously harmonizing.
I don't remember.
And then they come in and they start singing with you guys. You don't remember this?
No.
You have to watch this video. It's unbelievable.
Oh, good. I
was going to ask if this was planned or not.
No, it was definitely not planned.
It was definitely not planned. No. You have to watch this video because you and Daryl start.
You mean at the podium?
At the podium.
We were singing a Temptation song, I'm assuming.
You're doing this speech.
Yeah.
And it comes to the end of the speech and you go, why don't we just harmonize something? You and Daryl start singing.
Right.
And the Temptations come out of their seats in the celebration. They come onto stage and they start singing with you.
Oh, well, that's awesome.
You got to watch this video.
I have to watch it because I don't remember that.
This to me would be like the most mind-blowing thing. Okay, we're moving. We can't even talk about it. You don't even know about it.
I'll watch it though.
Okay, my other Hall of Fame question.
Yeah.
When you guys got inducted into the Hall of Fame, what was happening in the beginning of the set? Your monitors went out?
That experience, I have to say, I'm really glad we're in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I'm really glad because, as a career move, it's really powerful and it makes, you know, carries a lot of weight. But to be honest with you, the evening was just drudgery. We were there from 5 o'clock in 5 o'clock p.m. till like midnight. We didn't go on till almost the end. We were exhausted. We were tired. The only thing we had on our table was candy and wine. I was definitely having a low blood sugar moment, and it was just tiring. And then we got up there, and the shit wasn't working. The monitors went out. There was a crackles and stuff. And I mean, we managed to pull it off, but it was not exactly what I'd call fun. And what you see on the edited version of the television show is a completely, completely different experience than what was actually happening.
How can this be? It just seems insane.
Well, the night drug on and on and on and on and on. There was a lot of performers who talked a little bit too long. Let's put it that way. I'm not going to name names. But.
And you got up there and Daryl goes, let's just play.
Yeah, we were tired. We were like, this is stupid. Let's just get this over with.
Let's just play.
Yeah.
Fine. Well, it was a good performance. Once the monitors got fixed, it came together. Okay, so now you're doing this thing where you're putting out music, like you're putting out a song a month,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
And you just put out an amazing cover.
Yeah.
This month, right?
What a Wonderful World.
What a Wonderful World.
But I did a cover right before that, too.
Yeah.
Why Can't We Live Together?
Why Can't We Live?
Thomas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what is this because...
It's just what happened. I wrote a couple songs during the pandemic. I wanted to figure out a way of releasing them. I thought to myself, and I know through experience that no one is buying any physical product. You know, sure, there's niche audiophiles who love vinyl, but it doesn't really move the needle when it comes to actual sales. It's a streaming world. Let's face it, kids, and let's jump in with both feet. You know, that's how I saw it. So I found myself a digital distributor in the Orchard and a digital marketing company in Black Box and began to explore how to do this and learn. It was really a learning experience for me. So I've surrounded myself with some really great people who really know what they're doing. And I said, let's go down this road and see what happens. So that was the concept. And I released two of my original songs first. And then with what was going on with the Ukraine and what I was seeing and with all the past presidential elections and the riots and all that stuff was happening, I just revisited the Timmy Thomas song that he wrote in 1971, which was about Vietnam, essentially. And I said, this is a song that's time has come once again. And so I wanted to make it my own. I did my own version of it, released that. And then I was playing a lot of shows. And I wanted to, during the pandemic, I wanted to, once I started performing again, I wanted to sing the most positive song I could sing as a kind of an antidote to the 2.5 years that we all spent hiding in our rooms, right? And I just said, well, What a Wonderful World is maybe one of the most positive songs ever written. And I said, but you know what? It's interesting that it was always done as a kind of a slow ballad. And I thought, this song deserves to be an up-tempo. And I wanted to record it like a 70s R&B song. That sounds to me like something I would have done with Arif Martin in Atlantic Studios.
Yeah.
Even the playing style was like that. In fact, I told the guys, I said, I want to play this like a 70s R&B song. And of course, you know, and Steve Mackey's bass part on that song is amazing.
Who else played on it?
That was Steve Mackey. It was Guthrie Trapp on lead guitar. I played the rhythm guitar part. Greg Morrow was on drums. I use Greg Morrow almost all the time. I love his playing. I can't remember who played keyboards on that. But anyway.
Guthrie's told me this story that I think you first met him at, what, a bluegrass festival in Telluride?
Yeah.
And you came off the stage, and you had a guitar, and you just said, hey, here, take this. And you just gave him your guitar.
Yeah, I didn't want to carry it on the plane.
That is the most rock and roll thing ever. You're just giving, like, what are you doing, John? You're just giving away guitars, like,
well,
crazy.
I had a few drinks, I will say that. But no, what happened was he was on one side of stage. He was playing with Jerry Douglas. I was playing, I was jamming with Sam Bush. And it was the mighty jam at the end of the Telluride night.
You know, the
traditional thing where all the everybody gets up and jams. And he just blew me, well, all weekend he blew me away because I watched him play with Jerry. And then he and I hung out together. We went and watched Solomon Burke during the gospel Sunday morning.
You know, not to rat him out, he didn't know who you were. He didn't
not
know.
Not at first. No,
not at first. He couldn't even tell you a Hall & Oates song. He had no idea who you were.
He didn't.
He was just like.
But we went to the condo. We played some Doc Watson and stuff like that. And he didn't realize I could do that. But of course, he had no preconceived notion I could do anything.
Yeah, right.
So
right.
It didn't matter. but, you know, so I realized that we had a lot of the same folky kind of rootsy influences, even though he's a lot younger than me.
Yeah. And he's unbelievable, right?
Oh, he's amazing.
Yeah, he's amazing.
I love playing with him.
Yeah.
And we play together now all the time.
Yeah. Right. And then, but now you're also going on, you're doing like acoustic shows and you've got like a percussionist.
Yeah, I play sometimes with just myself, sometimes with me and a percussionist, sometimes with me and Guthrie, and sometimes me and Guthrie and a percussionist.
Yeah.
I want to keep it really streamlined and simple. I don't want to get into this thing with a band and amps and drum kits and all that stuff. So I've just been doing acoustic shows, and it's easy, fun, and I like telling stories and things like that.
The Arkansas record that you made, I guess now a couple years ago at this
it
point.
It came out in 18, made it in 17.
In 18.
Yeah.
But I've listened to that record so many times. The covers on that are incredible.
That was a magical record. You know, I was originally going to make a Mississippi John Hurt tribute album. That's what I wanted to do because I know his almost basically his entire repertoire. So I cut a couple tracks with just me and a guitar, you know, in the most traditional way possible. And it was like, you know, why bother? You know, why? Who needs me doing this again? Right? But what happened was it was one night, and I remember I was laying in bed watching TV or whatever, and I thought to myself, I've never heard these songs with a band. I said, I love these songs, so let me just try it. So I assembled this really eclectic band. So it was Guthrie on guitar, it was Josh Day on drums, and actually it was Josh Day on cajon and percussion because I didn't want a real drum kit. I wanted to make it as unusual and sonically unique as possible. Russ Paul, who's
a great steel player.
Mind-boggling steel player, and Nat Smith, cellist, who played with Casey Musgrave, among other people, and Steve Mackey on bass, and that was the band. So I assembled this band, you know, a cello, a pedal steel, and Sam Bush on mandolin, yeah. So it was like this really weird band that you wouldn't normally assemble to do a Delta blues record. Okay?
Yeah, right.
But I didn't want to do that. I didn't know what it was going to sound like. And we did a miss. The first thing we did was Steku Lee was the first thing we did. So I ended up playing just like Mississippi John Hurt, classic Mississippi John Hurt finger pickings thing. And I played it. I said, okay, guys, I'm going to do this. You do that. You do something else. I don't know what you're going to do, but just do it. And they started playing. Everyone just played naturally. And the beauty of the great players here in Nashville is that they really listen. They can really listen. They can listen on a critical level. And that's the mark of a great musician, someone who can really listen. And so we played it. We played it down a couple times, and it sounded really good. And I went in for a listen. We went into the control room to listen back. And my engineer, David Kalmuski, who has since become my co-producer on a lot of tracks, he said, John, I don't know what this is. He says, but it's amazing, and just keep doing it. So I said, well, if we can do it on this song, we can do it on anything.
Yeah, right.
And that's what happened. And so we cut like four or five songs the first week. And then I think we took a break for the holidays, and we came back in January, cut four or five more, and that was the album. And it really just happened. There was no, you know, I wish I could have said, well, I had this master, you know,
vision. For the
this
whole,
is, sonically,
all laid
it's
out.
Going to
oh
sound.
Oh, my God.
I just picked the best players I could. And as I learned from Arif Martin, I let them do their thing.
Yeah.
But I just guided. I guided the process. And it's really, that's the secret, to guide the process, but not step on it.
Right. Yeah. Why did you, after Sarah Smile became a huge hit, that was the moment that you said, I got to get some music education or I need to go to music school.
No, it was actually during War Babies.
During War Babies, you said that. I would think if I was you, I'd be like, I know everything. Like, I'm having hits. I'm top of the world.
I didn't know everything.
But what did you feel you didn't know?
Well, during the War Babies album, we had some players in the group who were kind of prog rock guys, jazzy prog rock guys, heavy metal, jazz, rock. And some of the stuff was very complex. There was multiple time signatures. There was it was just a lot of stuff that I wasn't – I could do it. I could hang because I have a certain amount of – I have good ears, and I had enough skill to hang. But I wasn't there, and I wasn't able to really – and I felt uncomfortable about that. And I thought, well, I can't go forward without really making sure I know what the hell I'm doing. So I kind of took a crash course, intensive crash course with a really unique woman named Helen Hobbs Jordan. She was in her 70s then. She seemed like she was 105, but of course I was in my 20s. Everybody who's old seems like they're 105 when you're in your 20s. But she played stride piano on the Transcontinental Railroad. Think about that.
Oh my God.
She played in the railroad cars going across the country.
For just like entertainment.
In the 1920s.
Yeah.
Whatever. Yeah. And she developed the curriculum at Juilliard, and she developed a basic curriculum at Berkeley. Well, it was what Berkeley used as a jumping off point for the curriculum. She had this very unique way of, you know, you're a musician.
Yeah.
She had a very unique way of teaching. So to just make it not too complicated, everything you did, you had to write, and you had to write it in three different ways. You had to write it in numbers, letters, four ways. Numbers, letters, phonetically, and score.
Right. And notes. Phonetically would be like notation. Solfege.
Notate. Yeah.
Yeah.
You had to be able to sing it. And, well, we haven't gotten that far yet. So you had to write it in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
Scale eight. Degrees,
yeah.
Basically.
One,
yeah.
You know, 1 through, like 1, 3, 5.
Right,
know?
Right, right.
Okay. Then you had to write it in do, mi, so.
Right.
Then you had to write the notes.
Like A, G,
yeah,
B.
Yeah, you had to actually write the triad, whatever you're going to write. And then you had to be able to sing that. You had to be able to play it on a piano, and you had to be able to write it. So everything you did, you had to do in alphabetically, phonetically, like solfeggio, and write it and perform it.
And did you know the notes on the staff, or was this the first time you were learning it?
I knew the notes on the staff from when I took early guitar lessons, but I was so rudimentary that I was basically starting from scratch. That's what you had to do. And then, in addition to that, you had to take three lessons with a solfeggio teacher, a writing teacher, a playing teacher, piano playing teacher, and then at the end of the week, you had to perform all that for her. Then you also had to audit a class ahead of you so that you had a general
idea.
What
was this program? Were you just making this up, or this was like a program?
This was her. When I first inquired around New York City, like, who's the shit? You know, who's like the person to go to? And they said, well, the only real professional, you know, music theory teacher is Helen Hobbs Jordan. So I just made an arrangement to meet her. She was on 57th Street, right between 5th and 6th. And I went up to her apartment. And first thing she told me is how she kicked Paul Simon out because he didn't do the work. And then she said, okay, well, she goes, if you want to get B's, you can just go to college. But if you're going to get A's, you can try me. Because if you don't get A's, you're not going to be here. She goes, she didn't pull any punches. And that was it. And I said, okay, well, I'm going to give it a try. And I spent 6 months with her, and I just did that. That's all I did. There you go.
And do you feel like that was the last time you had a big musical growth in terms of learning? Like, for me, like, when I was at Berkeley, that was the last time I feel like
really gave me a foundation. It gave me a music theory foundation that I didn't have, and I needed it. And now I have it. So now I can communicate on any kind of level with any musician, basically.
So prior to that, would you be saying like, hey, this is a 1, 2, 5
no,
or whatever?
I wouldn't say anything. I
would you would just say, you would have no idea of what you were. You were like, this sounds good.
I play a bunch of cowboy chords, you know, at the bottom of the neck and just be happy with that. And every once in a while, figure out something a little more sophisticated. No, another part of my music education had to came from playing with Daryl because he was a piano player. So I had to translate his, you know, he's a really good piano player, and he used a lot of, a lot of unusual, you know, voicings, and he would also, you know, do a lot of, pedaled bass notes and moving chords under a bass note, things like that. So I had to translate that to guitar. So I had to literally finger my way through these piano chords. So a lot of times people will always say, well, you play guitar like a piano player. And I said, well, yeah, there's a reason for it, you know. So
yeah, makes sense.
Yeah.
You guys ever going to go back out again or?
I don't know. It's hard to say.
Hard to say.
We're on a permanent hiatus for a while.
Yeah, 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 yeah. All right. You guys had some of the first shows back, though, after the pandemic.
Yeah, we managed to get a couple. In the world, there were a couple we had to do contractually.
Yeah.
Yeah, we managed to squeeze enough in to get kind of satisfy our commitment, let's put it that way.
When did he start playing guitar on stage? Because wasn't he mostly just singing vocals and then he played piano?
He started playing a four-string guitar.
Like a tenor?
It was like a tenor guitar, but it was in a full size. And he actually had a couple made, some custom ones made. And then from there, he transitioned into playing guitar.
And were you like, hey, man, I'm the guitar player? Or you didn't care? Whatever.
Yeah, he likes the way he looks playing guitar.
Yeah. All right. John, I can't thank you enough for...
That was quite an interview. I didn't know that's where we were going, but I...
Coming on.
I'm open-minded.
Where did we go? What have we left out? Have we left anything out? Is there anything?
Oh, my whole life. Yeah, I mean, God.
The whole everything. Aspen, living next to Hunter S. Thompson.
Yeah, I mean, come on.
Why was
I'm a dad. Come on,
man. You're a dad. I know. What does your son do?
I can't tell you.
He's a musician also? Or
no.
Or just private life? Yeah.
He works in an unusual field.
Yeah.
Every time I ask him what he's doing, he says, I'm keeping you safe, Dad. So
no,
it's
amazing.
Just leave it at that.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Why was it so important? You make a point of this that you guys are not Hall & Oates.
We made that point very early on. No one paid attention to us.
Very early on.
But we did.
Why was that
important
to you?
Because we both realized we were two individuals, and we both kind of knew in the back of our minds that one day we are always going to be individuals and not be this. And, you know, we tongue-in-cheek named our touring company Two-Headed Monster, you know, because it's really that's what we always knew that, you know, we were two individuals who didn't necessarily need each other, but it worked when we were together.
Yeah.
And so, a friend of mine just recently told me, you know, he said, John, you came into the world as John Oates, the musician. He goes, you're going to go out as John Oates, the musician. He goes, you don't have to be part of anything. And that's how I kind of feel anyway.
Yeah.
So.
Are you offended by the term yacht rock?
I'm not offended by it, but I don't like it. And I don't even know what it means. Does it mean that you wear like a funny hat that looks like, the Captain and Tennille? Is that where it came from?
Because I think that like you'll see yacht rock cover bands who wear the hats and who dress up like they're sailors, and then they play music, and like 25% of their catalog will be Hall & Oates songs. Like it's almost fallen into in it. It's a thing.
I don't care for the term because I don't know what it means, and I've never.
You were on a yacht when you were writing these songs.
I've never been on a yacht. I've never owned. Well, I have been on a yacht, but I can't tell you what I did when I was on it.
What does that mean? What did you do on the yacht?
All I'll say is I was on a yacht in the harbor of Monaco during the Grand Prix in the 70s, and I'll let your imagination run wild.
What happened on this yacht?
Just let your imagination run wild.
Oh my God. Okay, but no. Yacht rock is not—it's not a good term, or what is it?
You know what? It's okay. I was just at Sirius XM recently. The Yacht Rock channel is their most popular channel of all their channels.
Yes.
Okay.
Because you guys are on it.
Well, good. You know what? If that gets the music around, that's great. I don't care what people call it. It doesn't matter. But all I know is that I did play with the original Yacht Rock band. And you know what happened? It was really really interesting, and I'll tell you. I was on the Jam Cruise, and I was part of the Jam Cruise, and they were part of the Jam Cruise. So they asked me if I'd come up and sit in with them on a song. I said, sure. And I said, let's do She's Gone. Great. So I get on stage. The weirdest thing happened. because Daryl and I have been playing that song for so many years, it has changed and evolved.
From what is on the recording.
And it's become a, it's not a completely different song. The essential elements are still there, but it's a totally different approach. And they played it exactly
like the record.
I'm telling you, and I was impressed because note for note, it was exactly like the record. I had no idea what they were doing. I was like, oh my God, what just happened? And now I'm up here and they're like, and I'm going, okay, all right, yeah, I got it. Oh. And I mean, they were so slavish to the original, you know, in a good way. But it was eye-opening. I was like, oh, so that's what the song sounded like.
What's that rotary guitar sound you use on that song?
I'm using a wah-wah pedal.
That's a wah-wah pedal.
I'm just wah-wah-wah.
That's what I almost thought it would have been something like programmed, but no.
It's a real wah-wah.
That's a wah-wah.
Programmed.
Pedal. I don't know. This isn't, you know, Kiss on My List or something.
The only programming that was going on in those days was on TV.
It was on TV.
It's called a television program.
Yeah.
No. It was a wah-wah pedal through a little Fender amp, you know, with my little Stratocaster. You know, wah-wah-wah.
That was it. Yeah. What's that guitar that you played in the Live in Dublin show? You were playing your Strat, and
oh, then you had another guitar. Oh, is it a blue one?
I think it was blue. Almost looked like a Les Paul, kind of.
Yeah, no, it's a TV Jones. It's a very.
Oh.
He makes pickups. He makes pickups for Gretsch and a lot of other people. TV Jones pickups are really popular and are great. But he made a guitar. I don't even know if he still makes them.
Yeah.
It's called the Model 10. He made two of them. One was a little bit larger than the other, and I just stumbled upon it and I liked it. I have two of them.
Very cool.
Yeah.
John, can't thank you enough for coming down.
Okay, Zach.
Coming down from all the way. You probably live close to here.
All the way from the West End.
All the way from the west side of Nashville.
Yes,
that's the best
right.
thing about Nashville. You're always so close.
10 minutes away.
10 minutes away. Thanks for coming on.
All right.
And we'll see you next time.
Okay. Thanks.
Whew. We did. Did we get it, John?
It was good, man. It was good.